Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Upgrade your kitchen today with Clearview Cabinetry. We offer a great selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and with cabinet accessories to match your unique style. View our selection of Clearview Cabinetry on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find plenty of great deals happening this week. Save big.
Want consistent color for every job? Mylow's Pro Rewards members get a 20% paint discount on future purchases after paint annual qualifying spend reaches $3,000. Plus, order eligible in-stock paint and paint supplies by 2 p.m. for free same-day delivery by 8 p.m. Improving is easy at Lowe's. Excludes spray paint and mist tints. More exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Subject to change. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Same-day delivery valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. Details at Lowe's.com/same-day-delivery.
Should she have had to run some sort of a primary?
The mistake was Biden not announcing either right before the midterms or right after the midterms, hey, this has been great. We did better in the midterms than any kind of sitting president has in a long time. I'm not going to be running for re-election because it is, you know, I am a transitional candidate. That's the real mistake.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Trailblaze. This is Jamal Simmons. I have got a really a good friend that's joining the conversation today, and I want to talk to him about what's going on in 2028. We are now talking about the next presidential election. I know folks are thinking about the midterms, but the midterms are not the only election coming up. Also, the presidential's coming, and we want to talk about that one. We're going to get it going soon. So I want to bring in my friend Matt Butler. Matt Butler has done a bunch of stuff with Democratic politics for a long time. He's an old friend. He worked for Media Matters. He worked for John Kerry. He worked on Democratic conventions, a bunch of other presidential and Senate races. So, Matt, thanks for joining Trailblaze.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. So this is going to be awesome.
Yeah, it's fun. So listen, all right, so let's just jump in. Because we're talking about 2028, and we are just, I know people might be thinking like, oh, we've got this other election that's coming up, but I think we're interested in 2028. It's never too early for a presidential campaign, right?
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, 2028 represents hope, right? Because it'll be the post-Trump era, either way. So I think people really want to look forward to 3 years from next week when he's finally out of office. We can, you know, go back to some sense of normalcy. But so I think talking about 2028 is we're talking about hope. We're bringing the hope here today, Jamal.
Absolutely. All right. So when we think about 2028, you put on your list for people who are, you know, really thinking about this running for president.
I mean, we've got a huge cast of characters who are thinking about throwing their lot in here. I mean, the most, you know, obviously the highest profile one right now is Gavin Newsom, governor of California. You've got Vice President Harris, who might throw her hat into the ring. A lot of people are talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, sort of as the person who's going to, you know, take the mantle of Bernie Sanders and move forward. Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, Pete Buttigieg, the former labor secretary and also or transportation secretary, and who also ran last time. I mean, we could go for quite a bit of time here listing candidates.
Okay, so let's do it this way. All right, so let's talk about there are governors, and then there are senators, and then there are people who are basically unemployed, right? The people who don't have a job. They don't have a job in politics right now, right? Yeah. So the unemployed list is the easier list. Like, it's the shorter one. I would say that's Kamala Harris, VP Harris.
Yeah.
Right? She didn't have a job. I would say that is also Pete Buttigieg.
Right.
Pete Buttigieg doesn't have a job. And then there's somebody else that I am forgetting who goes. Oh, and then Rahm Emanuel. We haven't talked about Rahm.
Yeah.
Former ambassador to Japan, former White House chief of staff, former congressman.
Mayor of Chicago.
Right. So, Mayor of Chicago, congressman of Chicago.
Yeah. And I don't know what job he's doing. I would doubt that Rahm doesn't have a job right now. I bet he's got that's probably pretty lucrative. So
all these guys have something they're doing that probably makes money. Like, you know, Kamala Harris.
I'm sure they're all writing books too. Yeah. They're all writing
books. They're all doing stuff. But they don't have a political job. And that's kind of the point. They're not a governor or senator or mayor. They're not elected to anything right now. So they're in one list. So who are our governors? Who are the governors who might run in 2028?
So we got Gavin Newsom, obviously, is the most obvious one. Josh Shapiro, yeah. the governor of Pennsylvania. Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan. Although I would say it looks like maybe she's not coming to make the race, which is a surprise, right? She was like one of the two or three people listed to replace Biden in 2024. Okay, so then we've also got Angie Beshear from Kentucky, Wes Moore from Maryland, J.B. Pritzker from Illinois. God, I have to go down the list. I mean, the list is so like, those are the major ones. I mean, Tim Walz is, I don't think was going to be making the race, but there was,
I think Tim Walz is talking
about it early on. Gina Raimondo,
We haven't talked about Gina Raimondo in a while. Former Commerce Secretary, former governor of Rhode Island. Oh, but she might go on don't have a job.
She may not have a job. So,
I think she's going to be unemployed.
But in terms of people who have been governors and kind of have that experience, she is up there. So, and you know, we have not tried the let's run a governor for president in quite a while. So it may be an interesting, play for the Democrats.
The Democrats have not run a governor for president of the United States since
1996, I would assume. Well, it was 92. No, was when he ran.
1992, right? Yeah, 92. So, 96 was a re-election.
96,
right?
You ran a president. Yeah, you ran a. We ran a president. That was kind of our first foray into the politics was back then in the early 90s. So,
So it's interesting because the thinking, if you talk to kind of the James Carville types and some of the others, is that running for president, governors are better. We should be running governors. But the reality is we haven't really run a governor in a long time. We've run all these senators for president. And frankly, the last two presidents who won, Barack Obama, who was a senator, sitting United States senator, Joe Biden, who was a former senator, who was then a former vice president of the United States. And you could argue, I might argue, that Al Gore also won. He at least tied.
He at least tied, but he didn't serve. So it doesn't much matter. I mean, I think on the Gore race and kind of the Clinton race too, it's sort of like, those were close, but they really should not have been close. I mean, Gore should have had a bigger cushion to be able to beat George Bush. He was much more qualified to be president than George Bush. And Hillary Clinton was, obviously miles and miles and miles ahead of Donald Trump in terms of qualification to be president. So, it's tough. So, we got to be way out ahead. So
we ran these senators. Basically, they've all been senators, right? Harris was a senator. Biden was a senator. Hillary Clinton was a senator.
Kerry was
a senator. Obama was a senator a few times. So, we run all these senators. And there's something about being a senator these days that makes it easier or better for them to run for president than being a governor?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of opportunity for senators to take some very high profile positions to get a lot of national attention. Most of the senators raise from a national fundraising base. So they're going to New York, to San Francisco, to Los Angeles, to Chicago all the time to raise money into their campaign. So their donor, their donor relationships are pretty deep. And so that helps you when you kind of get onto the campaign trail. Generally, they're pretty good debaters, right? Like they spend a lot of time talking in the Senate. They like spend a lot of time crafting arguments. And so they're all generally pretty talented people. And especially the ones that we've run have been incredibly talented. So,
this is an interesting thing because now we've got this difference between sort of the senators who basically can talk a good game and these governors who I think people would argue governors got things done. They have things to show for their tenure. They built a bridge, they changed an economy, they've got an unemployment rate that they can take responsibility for. But if you're a senator, you really don't have any of that. And that hasn't seemed to matter on the Democratic side. But on the Republican side, they have run governors. I mean, Romney was a governor. Trump wasn't a governor, but he was a business executive. So he did speak kind of as an executive, having run a company, even if you could argue how big that company was or how successful it was. He did run a company. So it's a little bit different between the two parties on this way.
Yeah, for sure. And, George Bush obviously was a governor at the time.
George Bush was a governor in 2000, right?
So I think it's, I think the argument that, that the governor and an executive kind of experience is really, really important. They have a big staff. They have to delegate. They have to hire people that they trust to run big parts of a state government. And so I think it really is, it's a more analogous job to being president of the United States than it is to be a senator. You know, I don't know where the disconnect happens when the senators are running and, you know, you're talking to people. So maybe governors are more effective, but, you know, you figure you had four elections in a row where, you know, Clinton twice and then Bush twice, where we had governors doing it both times. So,
you know, it's also true. Democrats tend to nominate people from the coasts. I think Obama was the last big exception. I mean, Obama and Clinton obviously weren't from the coast. But if you think about since 2004, Kerry was from Massachusetts. Hillary was from New York, ostensibly. Biden was from Delaware. And even Harris, who got the thing, you know, she was from California. So we've kind of become, I mean, in this sense, the Republicans are right in the sense that our politics have kind of become Washington voices from the coasts of the country.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And so we'll have to see. I mean, we'll see which of these candidates are going to kind of change that up. That would probably be good for J.B. Pritzker from Illinois. So, you know, right in the middle.
Yeah. So when we're talking about governors, one of the things about the governors is there are three of the governors who are on the list, everybody's list for running, Moore, Pritzker, Shapiro, but they got some business to take care of before they get to the 2028 race. All of them are up for reelection in 2026. So is that, do you think that helps them running, or do you think that hurts them thinking about running for 2028, the fact they've got to run this reelect first?
Yeah, look, I think this is like a super interesting part, and why it's interesting that we are starting to talk about this, or we're talking about it today, you know, 2 years out from the election, even though the midterms haven't happened yet. You know, this is, we're sort of in what, I can't remember who deemed it, or who kind of deemed it this, but like, we called it the invisible primary, kind of in 2002, where people start running, nobody's talking about running, right? Because you either have a job like Gavin Newsom, or you're running for reelection like, you know, Josh Shapiro. And so you don't want to be seen as running for president. You want to be focused on your state, or you want to be focused on your reelection. You don't want to be seen as looking towards that next office. Well, the only problem is that you really these days have to start very early in running for president. You have to develop donor relationships. You've got to build a staff. You've got to find people that you trust. You've got to get on game with your message and your messaging and your debate prep and like really being able to show up. So these guys have to do all of these things while not running for president. So the guys that do have, the people who do have races, they obviously have an advantage in that area because they get to put together a campaign staff. They get to look at polling. They have a reason for polling. They have a reason for traveling to different places. They need to raise money for their current race. So it really helps if you are in cycle to kind of be able to run and be able to get set up for next year. This happened to us in 2002 for John Kerry. He was up for his Senate seat. So there was, you know, there were tons of reasons for him to go all over the country, speak to people, be able to get donors, everything. We had a whole system built up. We knew what the campaign staff was going to look like before we got to 2003 when we actually announced that we were running for president. It was incredibly helpful for us.
So, I mean, obviously, the worst thing that can happen to one of these three is that they lose.
Yeah.
Right? They can be running, but, and they might lose that
Jeb Bush, 1994. Yeah. Jeb Bush, 1994. He was the one that was supposed to be the heir to the Bush legacy, but he lost to Lawton Childs in Florida in 1994. And George Bush won, served 8 years as governor. And then guess what? 2000, he's the nominee. And Jeb Bush is asking people to clap for him in 2016. So, you know, it really does. Things can get thrown off. So you cannot, you know, you can't take your eye off the ball and just assume you're going to get elected.
I will tell you, I'll take a look. And I've heard rumors about this from some of the campaigns, particularly the ones that are in the safer states, right? Like Illinois and Maryland. I mean, Josh Shapiro's got to run basically a general election presidential style campaign in Pennsylvania, because he's got to win those same voters in that election that he would have to win if he was a Democratic nominee for president. But if you're Wes Moore in Maryland, Maryland's a pretty blue state. It's pretty progressive. You've got two big urban centers in Baltimore and the DC suburbs. But you do have this kind of Eastern Shore, you know, conservative arc, right, that goes through the state. And I would say if I'm Wes Moore, I'd want to spend more time in that part of the state and see what I can, see what I learn, see what messages resonate, see how people react to me out in kind of the more conservative places.
Yeah. And you know, out west, you're kind of mixed in with West Virginia, right? I mean, it's like you can go back and forth between Maryland and West Virginia driving to Pittsburgh a couple of times. So, and that's, you know, that's very much like Pennsylvania, kind of that rural Pennsylvania area. So I think he's got a great opportunity to be able to practice, hone his game, hone his messaging, figure out how to talk to those folks. He may not necessarily need them to win the state of Maryland, but it'll be great practice for him if he's going to run for president, because he's going to need them across the country.
Yeah, and if he can run the score up, I mean, he ran, you know, last time in 2020. I'm sorry, in 2022, when he ran the first time for governor of Maryland. If he overperforms in 2026 in those parts of the state, it's a pretty credible argument in a fundraising meeting that he might have some sway with more conservative voters.
Yeah. And then there's also the governors who are not up for re-election. So you've got Andy Beshear in Kentucky, who people are talking a lot about. Now, he doesn't necessarily have a political campaign reason to be going across the country, but he did get himself installed as the chair of the Democratic Governors Association. So he's now responsible for all of these governors running in all of these different states that are up, that are in cycle. And he gets to go raise money, meet those donors, help out people, really build political connections, build his political operation. And so that's going to help him immensely as we go into 2027.
Yeah. You know who also was chair of the Democratic Governors Association in the cycle before he ran for president? Was Bill Clinton.
I believe it was Bill Clinton. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So it does help you. It does, you know, it helps you get your messaging right. I can remember in the Wayback Machine when Barack Obama did this in 2006. In 2006, he spent that election cycle traveling around, doing events, meeting people, not just doing fundraisers, which Hillary Clinton did a lot of fundraisers, but she didn't do a lot of public events. But he did public events with people. He tested messages. He heard what the other candidates were saying. And I think that helped him when he started to show up on the campaign trail in 2007 and 8, because he had kind of been around the country a little bit and had some understanding of what people were thinking and feeling.
Yeah, I mean, he came out of that 2004 convention speech and just winning that election. I mean, he was just like a rocket to the moon. And, you know, he came out for us when I was running the Maria Cantwell for Senate campaign in Washington State in 2006. And I think that was in probably like mid-March 2006, did two or three fundraising events for us and did two or three public events for us. You know, and then his staff, you know, asked like, hey, we'd like to get all those lists from the people who attended. And, you know, we thought, sure, they were just talking about the fundraising list so that he could continue to fundraise from those folks. And they're like, no, we want the political list too. And we want the activist list. We want to see everybody that came to the events. And I'm like, what is this guy thinking about running for president? This is like, and I'm like, that was just naive, you know, 35-year-old campaign manager, Matt. But yeah, sure enough, he was building a political operation and he went to think maybe 40 states or 40 different campaigns to help. So, you know, it's great to be able to go and help people.
I spent the last weekend of the 2006 election in Nashville, Tennessee, where Harold Ford was running for the Senate. But I actually think one of the reasons Harold Ford got beaten in that Senate race was because Democrats were doing so well a lot of other places that Republicans had to concentrate on a few places they thought they could win. And Bob Corker is the one who ended up beating him. But what I remember is, being in the Obama and Harold Ford are on stage speaking. And I remember standing in the outside, and I saw these two, frankly, these two kind of middle-aged white women walking into the event, and they were wearing Obama 2008 buttons. And I remember thinking, like, what are they talking about? And so I went over to them, and I said, hey, where'd you get those buttons? And the woman said, oh, there's a guy out front. He's selling them $2 a piece. I was like, wait, you're paying for, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. White people are paying for buttons for an African-American senator from Illinois who hasn't even declared himself to be a candidate for president yet. What is going on here?
Yeah,
it was pretty amazing.
He was, you know, and that's, you know, look, I think if you look at the field, I don't see anybody who is immediately popping out as some of the, you know, as the next generational talent that is like Barack Obama. And, you know, I mean, that was just the 2008 primary. I mean, that was just a heavyweight of a fight with Hillary Clinton against Barack Obama. I mean, I don't know that we'll ever see two, you know, incredibly strong candidates and qualified candidates like that. Yeah, definitely Titans. So
so we haven't talked about the senators. And so if we think about the ones who are sitting in the Senate right now, who are thinking about running for president, on my list, I've got perhaps Alyssa Slotkin, perhaps Cory Booker.
Yeah.
And then my sort of personal favorite, which is Mark Kelly from Arizona. A senator from Arizona. I think he's one that people should keep their eye on, especially because the more Donald Trump and Pete Hegseth fuck with Mark Kelly, I think the more they make him a more credible candidate in the national scene. But there's some others. Who am I missing after that?
So also from Arizona, Ruben Gallego is talking about running and thinking about that. You've got Raphael Warnock from Georgia, and also potentially John Ossoff. I mean, he's at least being mentioned on the prediction market sites. So there's definitely some chatter about that. Oh, you know, both of these guys have won tough races, and Chris Murphy from Connecticut. Yeah. So having worked for a presidential candidate from Connecticut, you know, I've got a little soft spot in my heart for Chris Murphy. So, you know, he's going forward with this. So if he does, it's going to be good.
And then we've got, which almost never really works out, but we're in a world where strange things happen. So we got to mention them. The members of Congress who are running, you always get a few members of Congress who run. It's usually a personal branding exercise more than it is a real stab at it. But you mentioned AOC when we started. We also, Ro Khanna is on that list for the members of Congress who are thinking about doing it.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's any others that are very particularly prominent this time. I don't know that there are, but some will probably pop up, right? There will be a Tim Ryan this time. There will be an Eric Swalwell that's going to try to go for it. And we'll see. We'll see. And you know, at the very worst, that they're going to really raise their profile to be able to get into the national conversation, depending on how they perform. And so it's probably going to be good for their careers to do it.
All right. So let me ask you this. So I have been told before that they're, you know, running for president is not really a marathon. It's more like a decathlon. I heard Barack Obama say this once. It's more like a decathlon. And so you got to compete in like 10 different kinds of events. So on your, what do you think makes a credible presidential candidate? What do they have to do to sort of show that they're really serious about this?
Look, I think you've got to have a massive fundraising operation because you just don't do it without a lot of money. Now, that can be the high dollar route and having really good high dollar donation and bundlers kind of relationships. That can be the more Bernie Sanders route and doing it all with low dollar fundraising. Or you can do a mix of both, which is obviously the best. But it's going to take a good amount of money to get through this. So that's kind of one of the fundamental skills. Also, with a field this big of, you know, if it could be 20 people, there's actually just not that much political money out there. And so you're going to be able to have to feed your campaign or you're not going to be able to have an operation. I think you've got to have pretty good executive skills because you've got to be able to put together a team that can do all of the elements of campaigning. You've got to have a really good scheduler. You have to have a really good press team. You've got to have great speech writers. This is not something you can do on your own. You've got to have great media consultants. You've got to have good pollsters. So
you need a Matt Butler. You need a Matt Butler. You need somebody whose job it is to watch that budget.
I don't know. Those are easier to find because you can find. There's lots of accountants out there. So,
but you know, there's lots of people though. But this is I'm kind of making a joke about it. But there are all these reasons we're in a campaign where someone says, "Oh no, we got to like sponsor this table at this dinner," or we need to put this amount of money into early media in this place to make it work, or we need to do something. There's always a reason to drain that money as it's coming in, but you need somebody who's the asshole inside the building who's like, "No, we're not spending money on that. No, not yet. No.
I think back 20 years ago, I probably played that role with a little too much aplomb. So I don't know that I could do it again today as I've mellowed significantly. But I mean, I think, you know, making yourself, you know, hard to go to because people didn't want to come and ask for money because you'd get a lot of pushback. And that was sort of the nature of the job as CFO back in the Kerry days. So,
well, somebody has to do it because we talked about Kamala Harris earlier, and one of the big Knox on the Harris campaign in 2019 when she ran for president in that cycle was she raised more money, had the biggest launch of anybody running, and didn't even make it to Iowa, didn't even make it to the very first, or New Hampshire, didn't even make it to the very first political contest before she had to get out. And she was basically out of money. And if you're out of money, you can't run for president anymore.
That's right. And, you know, Howard Dean did the same thing. They raised so much money over kind of the second half of 2003 and blasted it all off and were like basically not paying staff after Iowa and New Hampshire and like just sort of limping through to Super Tuesday. People took staff cuts and, you know, but they were spending money on all kinds of different stuff. You know, there's all kinds of gear. Remember the orange hats that were out there in Iowa, all kinds of stuff. And, you know, look, they were, you know, running away with it. And so, you know, I think, you spend the money when you've got it, but you got to be a little bit judicious and kind of hold on. So maybe they didn't have enough of a stickler kind of back in the headquarters.
I love talking to you about this because we can always, you and I can go back in history like 30, 40 years on this stuff. And you know, at some point we'll be like, but what happened to Ted Sorensen on the Kennedy campaign? You know what I mean? We'll go into all of it. But, you know, last presidential campaign, before we go, the last presidential campaign had, it was kind of a shit show, right? Like, let's just say it out loud, right? Like, the candidate was older. People said to us, literally, for like 2 years, they thought that Joe Biden was too old to run. The Democrats was too old to run. And yet, the Democrats still put him up to run again. He decided to run. And then when it finally had that debate performance where everybody kind of saw age and like living in color, that it wasn't working, we had this kind of coronation of the vice president and made her the Democratic nominee, which a lot of people were upset about. When you look back at it, do you think that it was a mistake for us to just like make Kamala Harris the nominee? Should she have had to run some sort of a primary? What do you think about this?
No, not at the time that she was given to run. I mean, the mistake was Biden not announcing either right before the midterms or right after the midterms, like, hey, this has been great. We did better in the midterms than any kind of sitting president has in a long time. I'm not going to be running for reelection because it is, you know, I am a transitional candidate. That's the real mistake. If we'd been able to have a full primary, I think there's a very real chance that Kamala Harris would have been the nominee after a full primary, but she would have built her own staff. She would have gotten comfortable with her messaging. You're just the process of running a primary campaign gets you so much better prepped and you know, you're battle hardened, your team is battle hardened, so much harder, so much better prepared to be in the general election, be able to mix it up. So, but no, by the time he's dropping out in late June, early July, and the convention's maybe 4 or 5 weeks away, we needed to get behind one candidate and we needed to go with it. And honestly, the first, I think maybe 50 to 60 days of her running, I think she was absolutely incredible.
Oh, like
her debate performance was fantastic. Her convention speech was great. You know, she picked Tim Walz, who was the candidate that she felt most comfortable with, even though people were telling her, oh, no, it's Shapiro for the votes and stuff like that. But Walz was also great coming out of that. Like, and then, you had the Trump debate and then sort of the Walz-Vance debate. And that at that point, it just sort of, I don't know, petered out. And I don't know if that is because they started sort of running this sort of like defensive, like, let's not screw this up kind of campaign messaging strategy. I don't know, or whether, you know, it just kind of caught up with her that, you know, people are not,
I think some of it,
she did great. And I think that we made the best of a bad situation. I don't think we screwed that up.
I would say that the first point you made about what happened, like when Biden should have gotten out, that it's almost like the Democrats did better than they should have done in the 2022 midterms. I was the White House then.
Yeah.
And we were all surprised. The Democrats did better than we should have done in the 2022 midterms. But that gave Biden like a false sense of power, right? I think that you come out of that, you say, I beat this guy last time.
Yeah.
I passed a lot of legislation that matters. I don't want somebody else to benefit from the things that I've done. And I just had this kick-ass midterm based on historical factors. Why shouldn't I? And I'm feeling good. Why shouldn't I run? So in the winter of 2022, going into 23, you know, you make this decision that you're going to run for president. The real problem, I think, then is you get to the end of 2023 and going into 2024, and it's obvious that, you know, President Biden's slowing down. People are starting to whisper about some of the things they're seeing. At that point, that's the place where the advisors really should have taken him into a small room and said, sir, you've done the best you could, but I think it's probably time for somebody else to do this. And at least maybe then you would have had, you know, the winner of 2024 to like have a full campaign and not just, you know, have this debacle that we had in the summer.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely. That certainly having a real primary would have been the best solution to trying to figure out who the nominee is going to be. But you know, given where we were in time, I mean, I think the coronation of the vice president was the right choice. And you know, it makes sense. I mean, we elected her.
There were some practical arguments. I mean, you've done campaigns, you've done conventions. You know, one of the practical arguments that was convincing to me, because I was originally in the let's have a mini primary camp, like let's just let everybody say what they have to say and take a vote. But there was the question of like of the bank accounts. All these people had given money to the Biden-Harris campaign. And if Biden dropped out, what would legally be possible for them to do with all that money? And maybe the fact that Harris was still on the ballot, her name was on the account. So it was a lot easier functionally for the party to just keep that money going, keep a lot of the infrastructure in place, and not have to rebuild it.
You're so close to the convention. You just have to start making decisions about what the television program that is the 4-day television program that is the convention. What are you going to say? You've got to make those decisions. That's like more people are going to watch that than any other moment of the campaign, other than maybe the debates. So it's a really important time, and you got to get that right. And I all credit to the Chicago convention team, because that convention was awesome. Awesome convention, awesome debates, unfortunately, do not win you a presidential election. So
what I think, you know, you talked about the lag that happened after that. I think one of the things that happened is the people in the Biden campaign were lying to us, lying to America about how well that campaign was being run. And the truth is, I think they didn't really have a lot of infrastructure for volunteers. And some people would say that Biden didn't have a lot of volunteers. So they didn't spend a lot of time building the volunteer infrastructure. They didn't have... they weren't making a lot of the calls that you would think people would be making in campaigns. And some of the things, they had offices open, because I think President Biden liked to have offices open. But you didn't have the infrastructure that was really working and robust. So Harris and them win, and I kind of know a little bit about this because then all my friends go into the campaign and they now are in the jobs. And so I'm now starting to hear like, oh, yeah, there's an office open there, but nobody really works there. There are all these people calling the campaign who want to volunteer, but literally there's no volunteer infrastructure. So we've got to hire people who can run a volunteer program. So they were doing the best they could for weeks, but at some point they had to sort of catch up in terms of building the infrastructure underneath the excitement of the candidacy that could actually support her in the general election.
Right. And also remember, you know, Biden's campaign in 2020 was so weird because of COVID and not being able to do anything. It's not like they had run a full campaign with a full field operation that they could just be like, oh, this, we just need to do this, this, and this. Like, we've got exit amendments on how to build this. And so, you know, everybody was doing it for the first time. So, I mean, look, I think most of the people worked as hard as they possibly could. I can't imagine what it would have been like to be, you know, in that campaign, feeling the highs and the lows of going through that. So I feel for all those folks, and I think they did a great job. But, you know, we made some big mistakes kind of on a strategic level. And obviously we lost to Trump for a second time, which, you know, it's still hard for me to understand. It's inexplicable to me that would happen. But
so here's one thing that might thing that might make it better is you know, the last time we had a one term presidency with the Carter presidency, which is before my political, like, I wasn't active in politics seven, but it was a Carter presidency, and right after the Carter presidency, you got the Mondale nomination in 1984 after Carter lost in 1980. And so Mondale runs against Reagan and Mondale loses. In some way, it might be that like history is moving faster, right? So it's almost like we collapse the 1980 and 1984 cycles into one bad 2024 cycle. Right? And so now we can say, like, you know, the vice president had a shot, the president had a shot, the vice president had a shot. That part's over. God willing, Donald Trump won't be on the ballot again. And this could be an election where you have two really new faces at the Republican, top of the Republican ticket and top of the Democratic ticket, you could have two new faces and we could, you know, and we can win a fight. Or maybe it's J.D. Vance, who we could have a whole conversation about that next week, maybe. It's maybe J.D. Vance and we're running against the Trump-Vance debacle because America is sort of tired of the incompetence and malfeasance that we're seeing out of this administration.
Yeah, I think it's. I like your. We lost Carter with Biden in the middle of just the summer, and then we lost the vice president with Harris. I guess what I would say is being the former vice president has been a really good way to get the nomination to be president. Does it not mean you're going to win? Yeah, right. Doesn't mean you're going to win. But we've lost a couple of those. I have some sympathy for Harris. She didn't get to run a full campaign. A lot of these guys, like there was talk in 2004 of Al Gore. Was he going to try to run again? In 2008, it was like, oh, is John Kerry going to run again? Like, it generally doesn't seem to happen, or it hasn't happened in a while. But, you know,
if, 1956. Yeah, Adlai Stevenson.
But if Vice President, then he lost again. So, yeah,
exactly. My dad was a child. Exactly. That's how long ago that was. My father was in elementary school.
It's not a great analogy. There's not a good track record with there. But, you know, I think if Vice President Harris said, look, I don't feel like I got a full campaign to do this, I'd like to try again. I don't think that anybody can say she's not deserving of that. The delta between the 2019 campaign performance and her 2024 campaign performance, you clearly see that that is a candidate that gained a lot of skills in those 5 years. And like being vice president definitely helped her. She's going to be somebody to have to reckon with if she decides to run. I don't know if she will, but certainly we're going to have to take a look at her.
Absolutely. If she decides to run, she deserves whatever shot she can take. And then we'll have to see if she makes it through the system. I think the primary system is grueling. And as we started to go through kind of this list and the decathlon, you know, it's money, it's staff, it's, you know, grassroots support, it's great candidate performance, it's message. You can't underestimate that, you know, tapping into something people want to hear. It's like kind of the informal candidate performance, debate. Performance matters, speeching, debates, and informal stuff. So there's a lot of things that really matter. And the one thing about politics, I say it's like, if you're in a political campaign, it's like everybody's walking around with a book of matches in a field of like dried out kindling, right? And you're constantly just like throwing matches, trying to see what's going to catch.
What's going
to
catch?
And you never know like what catches. And when it does, you got to be ready to like take advantage of that moment and really run on it. So they all have work to do.
Yeah, and we could talk about this for hours and hours and weeks and months. So anyway, so maybe, it's going to be fascinating to watch.
Maybe we should. All right. If people are interested, I think we're going to do this again next week. You got time next week to do come back into this?
Year? I probably could do it. We can go a little more in depth into some of the operations and the people.
Absolutely. So folks, I think Matt Butler and I will be back here talking about the 2028 campaign for the next week and maybe the week after that and the week after that. And we'll see how this goes. I like it.
Yes. All right. I'm for it.
See you next week on Showbase.
Jeff. Thanks, Jamal.